You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which makes these free Aloud programs possible. And it is my pleasure tonight to introduce Joyce Appleby and Peter Barnes. They will be in conversation, and after their conversation, we will open it up to you so that you can ask questions of them, and we will circulate a microphone because we do record for podcast. So please wait until it comes to you so that we can all hear your question. And afterwards, our authors will be signing their books in the lobby. As we watch the footage, as many of us are, of the upheaval in Egypt, and while we listen to the voices of the haves and the have-nots, it's probably a very good time to consider the dominant economic system in force in the world today, capitalism. Given capitalism's central role in modern economic thought and the increasing experiments with capitalism from some of the world's most populous countries, we can consider how capitalism might be reinvented for the 21st century. To spearhead this conversation, we've brought together one of the country's most distinguished historians, Joyce Appleby, together with one of this country's most inventive social entrepreneurs, Peter Barnes. Joyce Appleby writes, "Capitalism is not a unified, coordinated system, despite that suggestion in the word system. Rather, it is a set of practices and institutions that permit billions of people to pursue their interests in the marketplace." Joyce Appleby, professor emerita at UCLA, is an esteemed historian of early America and the author of several books, including Inheriting the Revolution, The First Generation of Americans, A Study of Thomas Jefferson, and her most recent book, The Relentless Revolution, A History of Capitalism. She's past president of the Organization of American Historians and the American Historical Association and the Society for the History of the Early Republic. And Peter Barnes, who joins us tonight from beautiful Point Reyes Station. He's an entrepreneur and writer and is currently a senior fellow at the Tamales Bay Institute in Point Reyes. In 1976, Peter co-founded a worker-owned solar energy company in San Francisco, and in 1983, he co-founded Working Assets Money Fund. He subsequently served as president of Working Assets Long Distance, and in 1995, he was named Socially Responsible Entrepreneur of the Year for Northern California. His previous books include Capitalism 3.0, A Guide to Reclaiming the Commons, Pawns, The Plight of the Citizen Soldier, The People's Land, and Who Owns the Sky, Our Common Assets and the Future of Capitalism. And he is also the founder of the Mesa Refuge, a writer's retreat in Northern California, which, in the spirit of full disclosure, I will say I have attended, and it is heaven. Please welcome Joyce Appleby and Peter Barnes. Thank you.
Good evening. Peter and I thought that maybe we would begin our program by describing and or telling why we wrote these recent books on capitalism. In my case, the idea of writing a history of capitalism was suggested by an acquaintance, a man actually who had interviewed me on a NPR program he had in San Francisco about 20 years ago. And then about 15 years ago, he came to Los Angeles and he asked if he could meet me, and we met and had a cup of coffee, and he said, "You ought to write a book about capitalism." And I sort of stared at him. You know, after all, I'm an early American historian, mainly emphasizing the 17th and 18th centuries. And so I just smiled, and we continued to have our coffee. And then he came back the next year, and we had coffee, and he said, "You know, you really ought to write a history of capitalism." So I said, "Well, what would I say? What would I say that's so important for people to know? If you could just give me a couple of paragraphs, I'd consider it." And so he gave me some paragraphs about what he thought I knew that other people should know. And I realized that it was that I had stressed in my work that capitalism was a cultural system. And this is what he thought needed to be talked about. I did this in the first book that I wrote, in which I wanted to solve a mystery. And the mystery had to do with writings in English literature. If you look at 17th century Puritan sermons or Elizabethan drama, you'll see a view of human nature as completely disruptive, turmoil, fickle, impulsive. If you were Elizabethan playwright, you used this to make comic dramas. If you were a Puritan, you stressed that people were bathed in sins, absolutely incapable of going correctly on their own. But if you read Adam Smith 150 years later, human beings have sobered up. They can take care of themselves. They're ambitious. They're self-reliant. They're self-improving. They make good judgments in the market. I thought, how did this happen? What happened in the 150 years in between? And so I had a year to spend in London, and I decided to look at all the economic tracts that had been written between the time of the Puritans and Adam Smith. And what I discovered was that while England, and it was the pioneer capitalist country, while England was changing its economy, these changes were being observed over this century and a half. People saw that their farmers were improving agriculture and they were raising yields, and over time food prices dropped, and soon they released laborers and money for other pursuits. They saw that artisans were introducing a division of labor in their shops. They saw new financial institutions like the Bank of England being formed and a national market created, and then finally mechanics taking the knowledge that came from natural philosophers about natural laws were creating machines fueled by fossil fuel that could twist and turn and push and pull objects, just revolutionizing manufacturing and transportation and mining. And over the course of time of making these observations, they kept dropping comments about human beings, and slowly you could see this new view of human beings as being quite, as I said, sober and self-improving, taking over from the early 17th century view of fickle men and women. But when a century after this, now I'm talking about the late 18th century, when you had a new field of economics develop, people wrote about the economy as though it were a totally self-regulating natural system. It followed laws like the laws of aerodynamics. It was a machine that went of itself. It didn't need any human intervention. Indeed, human intervention was a very bad thing. Well, this is what my friend wanted me to do. He wanted me to restore that counter-narrative about capitalism as a social system, as a cultural system, so that we would have a better understanding of it than this model of it as a model natural operating system. And when I thought about it, I realized that I had a political motive for writing The Relentless Revolution. And that was that if we, who are participants in this capitalist culture, recognize that, then we will have a sense that we can influence it, that we can shape it. We won't feel that it's like the weather, that we can only deplore it and do nothing about it. So that was important to me that kept me going as I was writing it. And I also thought at the outset I would tell you that as an economy, I consider capitalism to be a set of practices that it enables individuals using their own private resources to put into practice plans for enhancing production or services that are going to be sold on the market. This sounds like a pretty ordinary definition. I wanted to get it out there so you'd know at least what I meant when I'm talking economically about capitalism. But every one of those elements of that definition, individual, private, initiative, went against the reigning values in 17th century England. So in order for capitalism to go from a few practices to an ism, it had to fight the defenders of the status quo. So this meant that capitalism had to capitalists had to become involved in politics, and eventually they had to change the habits and attitudes and behavior and values of their society. This is why it's a cultural system and why it's open to change from us. Capitalism draws on some very powerful psychological drives. It brings out, as all cultures work on human nature, and they bring out different arrows from that quiver of potential elements in a culture. It brings out the desire to strive, to be on your own, to be autonomous, to put into action your own plans, to compete, to take risks, to discipline yourself in the short run so that you can achieve long-range goals. These are important forces, but they need to be directed without squelching. They need to be nurtured within limits. They need to be tamed without stifling. And above all, they need to be made responsive to the needs of the whole community. So that, I think, is going to be our challenge this evening, is to explain and examine how capitalism can take up this agenda. Peter, why did you write a book on capitalism?
Good question, Joyce. Well, I'm now a retired entrepreneur. I was a businessman for 20 years. I practiced, a form of business where I tried to do it in a socially responsible way. I think I did do it that way. I have experienced capitalism, you might say, from the inside, which gave me a lot of insights into it. And, you know, I got into business for two reasons. One was that I didn't think I was employable, so I figured I'd have to create a job for myself. That was probably the main reason. But the second reason was I really wanted to see how far the system could be pushed. I mean, I knew I was never a big fan of capitalism, but I appreciated certain aspects of it, its openness, its dynamism, and the fact that if you could start a business and stay in business, if you could pay your, you know, meet payroll and pay all your vendors, then you could perhaps do things a little differently. And what I wanted to do in the businesses that I was involved in was test to see how far, you know, within the existing operating system, how far I could push it, or it could be pushed before you got crushed. And so my first venture was a solar energy company in the 1970s when Jerry Brown was governor. And, you know, there was a bit of a burst of interest in alternative energy in those days, which was crushed as soon as Ronald Reagan became president. Anyway, I started that company inspired. Actually, I had read E.F. Schumacher, a British economist who wrote a lot about this stuff. And he talked about employee ownership as well as appropriate technology. So I thought, all right, I'm going to start a solar company and run it as a worker-owned business. And I did that, and it actually worked for 8 years or so until Reagan eliminated the tax incentives for solar. Then I went on to start working assets. I don't know, are any of you working assets customers or Credo long-distance customers? Oh, great. I always love it when people know about that. All right, so, but to cut to the chase as to why I write about capitalism, it is basically because I want to change it. It desperately needs to be changed. It needs to be transformed. And I don't personally have any grudge against the system because it's been very good to me. But it's obvious also there are many millions, indeed billions, of people to whom it has not been good. And that the winnings of the winners as well as the suffering of the losers are both excessive, and that the burdens that capitalism places on the planet are unsustainable, and that these are fundamental flaws of the system that need to be changed. So that's what has gripped me, both while I was in business, although I didn't have any time to write while I was running businesses, but mostly since I retired, and have been looking for ways to change what I call the operating system of capitalism so that it does not produce this ever-widening inequality and it does not destroy the planet. So I have some ideas about how those changes might be made, and we'll get to that in due time. But I think I'm going to go back to Joyce now and ask you, Joyce, what you think, what are the challenges now that are facing capitalist countries, 21st century?
Well, I think we clearly need to get our financial house in order. And it's not yet clear that the regulations that have been passed are going to be as effective as those that were passed during the New Deal. I think we're also, we've got a very high level of debt to deal with, in the West in particular. It seems to me it's an absolute need that we get away from the short-term perspective that dominates financial services. I know that we all know that financial services represent a much larger portion of the gross national product than they used to, and we know that their recklessness plunged us into a recession that we're still suffering from. But I don't know that we've taken stock, really, of the deleterious effect of the financial sector's insistence upon finding or inventing investments that will give them a quick, high return. And what this means is that you're having the whole undergirding of long-term planning and the development that goes with really important innovations. This is being wrecked because of this insistence upon the quick monetary return for investments. And the country has only so much capital to invest, as it were, and I think that it's being diverted from really important economic challenges. I also think that globalization is still going apace, and we're being exposed, we're made vulnerable because we are exposed to the practices and policies of other countries. I don't think that this is going to change anywhere soon, so I think it's going to be very important to strengthen the international agencies and institutions that we have that make it possible to know in advance what these policies and practices are. And we're doing this at a kind of a bad time. It doesn't look like there's a new wave of innovation in the offing. And as I said, we have this load of debt. I think we're going to have to recalibrate our expectations of progress. And in some way, I think this is good for reflection. I think that when things are just going swimmingly, people don't really want to take the time to think about it. And now we do feel the pressure to think about it. I think we've seen that that these wise men were wrong. These models they had that were modeling risk were just utterly worthless. And even the high flyers are taking some stock of what's happened. So this is a chance for us to really engage the public in talking about it in TV shows and documentaries and articles and books and interviews and allowed programs, because it's going to take a full public discussion to change the attitudes, because they are so important in shaping the economy, what people think about it and what they expect from it. Other challenges to capitalism are endemic. They're not just these ones that have occurred in the last couple of years. And, of course, the critics of capitalism have made us very aware of its endemic problems. In The Relentless Revolution, I made a little list, which I will read you, of what the critics say about capitalism. They charge it with responding to short-term opportunities to the neglect of long-term effects, dispensing power without responsibility, promoting material values over spiritual ones, commoditizing human relations, monetizing social values, corrupting democracy, capriciously unsettling old communities, institutions, and arrangements, and rewarding aggressiveness and greed. It's kind of a pretty heavy charge. But some of these are more grave than others. Some threaten the economy itself, some challenge our democracy, and others threaten to destroy our shared ideals. And I think that the growing inequality is one of the problems that challenges all three. I mean, it's clear that low wages enable some American manufacturers to compete on the world market, but they have a really deleterious effect on our economy and our society. Keeping people poor and pushing them down towards poverty, just from an economic point of view, it shrinks purchasing power. It shrinks the capacity for Americans to buy the goods that capitalists produce. Yet it's hard for one company or one sector of the economy to raise wages when others don't. I'm sure that almost every firm in America would benefit if the workers of America were paid 20% more than they are now. And this points me to one of the complex features of capitalism. Prices, rates, supply, all of these are set by the aggregate of individual decisions. This means that no one is in charge, which we pretty much know. The individualism in this is good, it's a strong feature, but it's very, in some areas, it's extremely bad that we don't have anyone in charge, and I think the way in which the wage gap is widening is one of those. There are areas in which the public good has to be asserted over private interest. And counteracting poverty, as far as I'm concerned, is about the most important now. Yale economist Robert Shiller has recommended indexing the income tax to inequality. In other words, as inequality grew, the income tax would become more progressive. And he figures that if they had done that 30 years ago, they would have affected about half of the inequality that they have. A substantial raise in the minimum wage would help. There also, as you probably know, are living wage campaigns. About 52 cities in America, including Los Angeles, have living wage ordinances for their employees and people who do business with the city. This is small. It certainly is very small. But what I think it's going to do, and what I really put my faith in, is changing sensibilities. Now, I know saying that is going to make many of you think, boy, that's pretty naive, the idea that you would change sensibilities about low wages. But I will give you the example of slavery. Slavery in the West was abolished not because it was not economically sound. It was economically sound, and it would be sound today. And the same thing could be said about child labor. It, too, would work today. Lots of things children can do. They're dexterous, and they're small, and they can do things that adults can't do, and you don't pay them as much. So it was economically sound. And I know you're probably smiling as I'm saying this. But what changed? Sensibilities changed. They were no longer tolerated. Now, I think that we are going to see a change in sensibilities about low wages, about people working 40 hours a week and not being able to maintain a decent way of life. I think it will have to be a global movement. I see it in the demands and that the World Trade Organization be concerned about labor standards. But this, I would say, was the change that I put most of my hope in for eradicating poverty. Peter, I know you've thought a lot about inequality, and what are your ideas on how we are going to address it?
Well, while agreeing with everything Joyce has just said, I take a slightly different tack, which is not to focus on wages so much. I mean, I think the minimum wage should be raised and all of that, but I don't think that's ultimately going to solve the problem of inequality. Let me explain a bit why and how I would go about it a little differently. I was recently on a panel with Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, who has written a couple of very interesting books recently. Aftershock was one, and Supercapitalism was another. He argues, kind of like Joyce, that we do have to do these things like raise the minimum wage, invest in education, job training, all these things that will help people on the bottom lift themselves up. I don't think that's actually going to work. And I think the area, and I'll explain a little bit why in a second, but I think the area what we have to shift our attention to is non-labor income. Now, the figures, I don't have the exact percentages on the top of my head, although I did say in my book that the distribution of wealth in the United States is even more, vastly more unequal than the distribution of income, because wealth is really concentrated in the top 5% and even in the top 1%. The top 5% of American population has more wealth than the bottom 95%. And that was about 10 years ago, those figures from 2000. In the last decade, it's gotten even worse. All the growth in our economy in the last decade has basically trickled up to the top 1%, and everybody else has been either stagnant or falling down. So the inequality is increasing. And the reason the rich are rich and the poor are poor is not fundamentally about wages. It's about all these other sources of income, capital gains from buying low and selling high, dividends from stock in corporations, interest from loans. All these forms of non-labor income are what make the rich rich. They don't get rich from labor. They get rich from all these other things. And the poor and even the middle class don't really have access to that source of income. That is pretty much the preserve of the top 1% or the top 5%. So, and now on the wages thing, if you look back historically, or at least back to World War II and the end of World War II, the post-war period, the middle class in America grew, especially in the first 20 or 30 years after World War II. And a lot of it was due to wage growth. We had strong unions. We had manufacturing companies that dominated the globe. And that's because we didn't have much competition, because the rest of the world had been pretty much turned into rubble during World War II. So we were the dominant global economy. We sold our goods without a lot of competition, and we were able to pay high wages, and we did that. And we also did invest in things like the GI Bill. We built the University of California system. We did a lot of public investments, and we had this great global advantage, which enabled us to build a vibrant middle class. And that was wonderful, and I benefited from that. My parents benefited from that, and probably most of you did too. But that was then, and it's not a situation that we're in today, nor is it ever going to repeat itself. Whatever we think about globalization, the fact is that we are not going to be able to pay those high wages in the United States as long as we are competing with workers all over the world. So no matter how much we invest in education and job training and all those things, which are good things to do in and of their own, they are really not going to enable us to close this inequality gap within the U.S. So how are we going to approach this problem then? Well, let's get back to this question of non-labor income. We need to develop a way so that everybody can get some non-labor income to supplement their labor income. and it's not, they're not going to get rich off of non-labor income the way the top, you know, few percent do, but it will be a supplement which will be the basis for, you know, sustaining a middle class in this country and for reducing some of this inequality. So then you get to the question of, well, how can we share non-labor income? How can we make this something that everybody gets some of? And the model that most inspires me is something that exists in the state of Alaska called the Alaska Permanent Fund. I don't know if any of you have heard of this. If you know anybody who lives in Alaska, you probably do know about this. Every Alaskan gets a dividend every year. It varies, the amount varies from year to year, but lately it's been about $2,000 to $3,000 per person. So if you have a family of four, it's $10,000, $12,000 per family. That's a sizable chunk of change, and for a lot of people, especially the poor people in Alaska, it is really a critical piece of income for them. Now, where does that dividend come from? It comes from sort of a giant mutual fund that invests in stocks, bonds, and all these other things, but it's owned collectively by the people of Alaska. And everybody, when you are a resident of Alaska for a year, you in effect become, you have a right, a citizen right, a birthright, if you will, to a share of the income generated by this fund. Now, the original capital for this fund came from oil. And in Alaska, of course, it's been blessed with a lot of oil relative to the population of the state, so the fund got a lot of startup capital that enabled them to invest and pay these dividends to all the citizens of Alaska. Not every state obviously has oil in the same proportion that Alaska does, but all of us do, in effect, own a whole bunch of common assets that if we manage them properly, if we charged prices, proper prices for the use of those common assets, we would be able to get dividends comparable to what the citizens of Alaska do. And not only that, we'd be able to fight global warming and reduce pollution at the same time. Basically, just to simplify my kind of one of my key proposals is, we know that we don't charge appropriate prices for pollution. We don't charge appropriate prices for all the damage that we do to nature. And that is, in and of itself, one of the major problems of capitalism. If we treated the gifts of nature as kind of a commons that we all own together and we all have a responsibility to manage on behalf of future generations, we have to preserve these gifts of nature, which means we have to limit their use and charge increasingly higher prices for the limited use that we allow, and set that up in a trust so that the polluters would pay into this trust that we all own, we would kill two birds with one stone, in effect, or we would fix two of the major failures of capitalism in one fell swoop, i.e., we would reduce the destruction of nature, and we would generate a source of non-labor income that would be equally shared. And if you play that out over several decades, I think where we would wind up with would be a system of capitalism that is ecologically more in harmony with nature and also more equal in terms of the distribution of income. So that's kind of my approach. Now, what was I going to ask?
Shall I talk about what we might do globally?
Because yes, I think we can do globally to reduce poverty.
And I'd just like to make one comment about what you said, which I think is so important to realize, is that capital, as you described, generates wealth, and they enable people who have it to generate wealth, but it also generates power. It generates political power. And that means that our political process, whenever we want to get something done, we're always up against a lot of people that don't want to get this done, who have access to government in a way that most ordinary people don't. So I think that always has to be factored in, because when you think about things that are being done, you think, why aren't they done? But they're not. And I think with world poverty, it's much like Peter's and my discussion of going after domestic poverty. You have to do almost everything. Paul Collier has written a book called The Bottom Billion, and what it deals with is that bottom billion, actually it's a billion and a quarter according to UN figures, are people who are desperately poor and not going anyplace. We want to get all the 6 million people in the world. There are 1 million people in the advanced economies, and there are 4 million people in advancing economies. We have to give capitalism credit where credit is due, because hundreds of thousands of people have been lifted from poverty in China, in India, Malaysia, Philippines, Brazil. So capitalism is doing a lot of heavy lifting about poverty. But Collier's point is that these people are mired, they're tethered to the bottom, because their development is not going to help them, the usual investment coming in with more jobs and connecting with the market. They suffer from being landlocked, experienced a civil war, having corrupt government, and strangely enough, being rich and a resource. Because being rich in a resource gives their leaders the opportunity not to pay any attention to them. They can bribe anybody they need for the government to function. And Collier recognizes that these societies have to change from within, but he really believes that the outside world can intervene aggressively where there's real trauma in a society and put a lot of pressure on these countries to change. And in this sense, the Millennium Project, which the United Nations began, you know, in 2001, they said that they would eradicate poverty and hunger by 2015, which is, it sounds like a big goal, and we don't have much time to go. But coming here, I looked at a video of Jeffrey Sachs, and he thinks we're going to make the 2015 goal. And it's interesting. He pinpoints all of his hopes on the cell phone, that the cell phone is penetrating the isolation of communities all over Africa in particular. And we know the ways in which cell phones help entrepreneurs. Another very important factor of a single idea that's shown a lot of promise has been microcredit that Muhammad Yunus started, where he was teaching economics in Bangladesh, and there was a terrible famine, and he recognized that he just couldn't continue to be behind a lectern during this time. So he decided that he would lend money to people. He'd witnessed women in his community who bought bamboo, and they had to get the money to buy the bamboo from loan sharks. They paid prohibitive interest rates, but they needed it to make the things that they sold. And so he started with $27 and made 43 loans. I think money went a lot further than in Bangladesh, but at any rate, it was an amazing success with charged interest, but a very high return. That is to say, the debts were repaid. I went to Ecuador about 4 years ago with Finca, which is another micro-lending institution. I mean, Yunus's idea just took off. He has a Grameen Bank, and now there are hundreds of micro-lending institutions on all the continents of the world. But when I went to Quito, I visited the groups that borrowers had formed. Finca followed Grameen in saying that you can't just lend people money, you have to help them use it. And so they have regular meetings, weekly meetings. Even Finca even made the women in the group stand surety for each other, so that if one didn't pay off, they all were. And of course, these weekly meetings enabled them to talk about what they were doing. And it was sort of fascinating. There was a woman that visited her shop. She had about 4 people working for her. She just routinely went through all the dumps for scrap metal of some sort or other and then sold it. There were people that started grocery stores, really utility stores, kind of a 7-Eleven type, and about a 10-foot frontage in communities that had no access to retail outlets for 2 or 3, 4 miles. And they would sell, you know, aspirin and milk and bread and things like that, but they were very important to these communities, and they made a go of it. What's fascinating to me, I don't want to end on a sad note, but microlending has come in for some very bad developments because banks saw the opportunity. Here were these millions of people borrowing from these microcredit institutions, and so they went in to microcredit. And in India, these banks are almost uniformly backed by the major Indian bank, and they didn't have weekly meetings, and they didn't get people together, and they didn't educate them on how they should do these things, and they didn't have any control over them. People would fall behind in their debt, and they would take out another loan. There wasn't any control of their taking out another loan, and it's now just a major problem that may bring down the Indian bank, which survived the 2008 recession because of this. So it just shows you how important it is in these poverty eradicating programs to give some thought to what you want to do. The people who are now are not repaying their loans. That's why it's going to bring down the Indian bank. And as they said, at least with the loan sharks, you could go burn down their house. But not with these guys. Yeah. They loot and scoot.
Yep.
But eradicating poverty, microlending has been important, and I think it will continue to be important. It's just that these commercial exploitations are not going to be. And just one more idea that I think has been very good is the idea of a Peruvian economist named De Soto, who's examined the fact that around the world, people live on property and often run stores and businesses on property. They squat on it that they don't own. And their families may have improved this property for generations, but they have no access to the title, and therefore they can't ever raise any money. They can't use their property as collateral. And his goal, and he's working, has banking connections, he's working through international banks, his goal is to give these people secure title to their land, and to do this by cutting through the regulations. He has an estimate in Egypt, is in the news, an estimate in Egypt to even rent your property, there are 72 different processes that require you going to 41 different agencies. And now De Soto has taken this idea and is working in countries in Central America and Latin America in general and Africa and seeing if you can't get rid of these regulations and in enabling people in the shadow economies to get some secure hold on their land. Eradicating poverty is going to take more than cell phones. It's going to take more than microlending. But what I think the Millennial Project has done, it has set goals and it's got us talking about it. It's made it conspicuous. I think Yunus said something very wise. He said that poverty suffers from the fact that people have always lived with poverty and they think that it's always going to exist. And he said, and this is one of the largest obstacles to eradicating poverty, is being not comfortable with it, but accepting it. And it's going to take a change in that attitude. And of course, to go back to my analysis of slavery, is what happened with slavery. The anti-slavery movement was about 40 years old before it changed. So I do think that we can eradicate poverty, but I think we're going to have to keep it in front of us all the time in order to do that. Do you want to have a last
lick? Yeah, I'll have a last lick, then we'll throw it open to questions from the audience. Your story about what happened to the microfinance movement in Bangladesh and India is very interesting, and it brings home a sort of a fundamental problem that with capitalism, which is that it is inhabited, indeed dominated by these predatory institutions, banks, any kind of profit-maximizing corporation that will, when they see an opportunity, I mean, our subprime, thing is very analogous to what you were describing in India. They zoom in and, everybody else be damned. If they can squeeze a short-term profit out, they will do it. So we have to deal with this as a systemic flaw in capitalism. But in the few minutes I have here before we throw it open, I wanted to focus on another dilemma, which is the fact that we kind of have a double failure in America and perhaps even many other countries, which is we've got a failure of what we economists call market failure, which is, for example, you know, the fact that it doesn't cost anything to dump crap into the atmosphere. That is called a market failure. We've got a lot of those. But in addition to those, we now have government failure. That is to say that because of the nature of our political system and the fact that corporations are now able to dominate not only the economic sphere but also the political sphere, it becomes increasingly difficult to correct the market failures. We're actually in a dire situation because of this. Our two fundamental institutions, our market economy and our political system, both of which are kind of 18th century inventions that are now, here we are in the 21st century and we're living with these 18th century economic and political systems, and they're not working. And we always thought we needed to, that if, you know, whenever that there are market failures, okay, well, we'll have government step in and fix the market failures, and that's our solution. But that doesn't work. We have to face up to that. Now, where does that leave us? It doesn't leave us with a lot of room for hope, I have to say. But I think that there's still a little room for hope if we are clever and sort of prepare ourselves for the fact that even though corporations control the political process most of the time, maybe 10% of the time they don't have control. Like roughly once per century, if we look back at American history, there have been moments. Jackson, the age of Jackson, in the 19th century, in the age of Roosevelt, maybe both Roosevelts in the 20th century. And maybe we're due for another such moment in the 21st century. But we have to bear in mind that if such a moment comes, it won't last very long. And therefore, we have to use it strategically. We have to create institutions like Roosevelt did when he set up Social Security. Institutions that are designed to endure no matter how the political pendulum swings. Very cleverly designed, Social Security was. And and the Alaska Permanent Fund, again, which is a sort of a model that once it's set up, especially if it's set up, the equivalent of it is set up as a tool for reducing pollution, all of a sudden, you have everybody, you know, the middle class would actually benefit from pollution reduction. They would get money in their pockets because we are reducing pollution. If such a system like that were set up, if we had that brief historical window of opportunity and we used it to set up a system like that, that kind of a system would endure, as Social Security has for 75 years longer, regardless of the subsequent kind of political backlash, which is inevitable. I kind of personally came to this, I started thinking along these lines because of my experience in the solar industry, where you had a brief period where there were tax incentives for solar, and everybody jumped in and said, oh, let's do solar, and then politics swung the other way, and the tax incentives were gone, and that was that. Because there was no long-term constituency at that time in the 70s. You had a nascent solar industry which had no political power, and then you had fossil fuel companies on the other side, and guess who won? So that's sort of my closing point here, that even though things look grim, we should expect that there will be future windows of opportunity, brief windows, and we need to be able to use them strategically, to build institutions that will have durability, and over time they will reduce the impact of capitalism on the planet and reduce the inequality. So with that, we have a little bit of time for questions from the audience. So and we have a microphone that is wandering around. And,
a couple of them.
Yes, okay. Why don't the woman in the red over there will be our first.
First of all, thank you both very, very much. I couldn't possibly admire you more. But you talked about changing the psychology of the poor. And for me, what seems most profound and most difficult in this conversation is if you've seen the Charles Ferguson documentary, Inside Job. Oh, please.
It's on my list.
Because it seems that the most critical element that we must overcome is the psychology of greed in the 1%. That is absolutely all-encompassingly corrupt. And until we can change that psychology, I despair that we will be able to, you know, even the playing field. Therefore, Mr. Barnes, my hat is so off to you. And the question is, do you have some plan? Do you have some ideas about changing that psychology, getting people to be decent?
I don't think I would put a lot of faith in changing the psychology of the rich, though there certainly are obviously a lot of rich philanthropists. But I think laws, I think you can change the behavior with regulations, with laws.
But that doesn't seem to be working at all.
Well, that's because we don't have the laws. We don't have this carbon.
Right, right. Well, I agree with Joyce. I think the greed is an inherent human quality, and as Joyce said earlier, the social and economic systems tend to bring out certain qualities as opposed to others, and then it becomes kind of a self-reinforcing system. And unfortunately, we're trapped now in a system that reinforces and rewards, obscene greed. The only way we can break that, I don't think we're ever going to break it. I think it's always going to be here, but we've got to kind of constrain it with limits on what people can earn, or at least tax if they earn excessive amounts, take that back. I mean, one of my fundamental precepts is that these great fortunes that are made by people on Wall Street or other capitalists is not, I mean, they would like to perpetrate the myth that they earned every penny of these millions or billions and that they deserve to keep them. And if anybody wants to take any of it away, why, that's coercion, it's socialism, it's bad, bad, bad. Well, they didn't earn all of that. They may have earned some of that. I certainly give them some credit. But most of the great fortunes have become great fortunes because they are taking from the commons. This is the key point. They are taking wealth that really belongs to everybody. It's legal theft, but it is effectively theft. And we need to find institutional ways to keep what belongs to everybody in the commons and not let it be privatized by a few. That's what ultimately we have to do. Okay, in the way in the back there.
It's kind of a multi-part question, if I may. Wandering in a little late, I heard something about Thomas Jefferson ran through my ear. And to paraphrase a quote, Thomas Jefferson said that banks were more dangerous than the standing armies. Pursuant to the woman's 1%er, Michael Moore's most recent motion picture has an interoffice Citibank memo where the 1%ers express that this is the greatest of all things ever to be, that they can rule the world indefinitely and for all time, with the exception of only one exclusion, and that's one person, one vote. To put your world back together post this recession. To have good times, you have to put 900 million Chinese to work to fill Walmart. His philosophy is, whereas Henry Ford chose to pay his workers enough to buy his product, Walmart chooses to pay their employees enough to be forced only to shop with them. How can anything that complicated, when the Supreme Court gives corporations the same autonomy as sentient beings to contribute politically, does anyone in the room think any of that can be solved with something less than events like Cairo this week? Can you put all that together and say it's resolvable?
You want to take a crack? Or
so, I'm sorry. Was there a question there?
Yeah, I guess there was a question. Not that I have an answer.
Can you resolve this economy? Can you resolve capitalism? Can you say that? Is it safe?
Yeah, I'm not going to advocate armed revolution, but I think it's extremely difficult. I mean, you're absolutely right. I've seen that memo that Citi you referred to. They talk about plutocracy. They say we live in a plutocracy, but they don't say that critically. They say that proudly. And they say there's, you know, business opportunity to be found in providing services to the 1%, the plutocrats. And you're right, that the only thing that really threatens plutocracy is one person, one vote, but we can control that, you know, which they are. So, but whether the remedy is through mass, you know, uprising, or whether it can be done some other way, I don't know. That's a longer discussion. Joyce, do you want to?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that not everybody agrees with everybody else on these issues. If it were as you say, you know, all of us have exactly the same view, we could march on Washington. But there are many people who are very admiring of the economic system we have. And I'm sure that there's a lot of propaganda out there that reinforces that. But I think you have to realize that capitalism appeals to some very strong feelings that people have. I mean, I'm just reading about China and particularly India, and just reading a book last week about how the emergence of the market economy had just opened up the possibilities that people could control their own lives. Now, you know, we can mock that, or we can say, we can see how it's distorted, and there certainly are these flaws, but I myself have a great respect for this capacity to have an informal system that gives people an opportunity to follow through on a plan, to create something, to have a sense that they can make choices. And we seem to have these choices of a command economy or a free economy, and I think what we're arguing for is an economy that has many, many more regulations that direct that private initiative, that private energy, that private innovation to some very important collective goals. But I think it would be a grave mistake to think that capitalism isn't popular among many, many people, and that's why the votes, we don't have the votes for every measure.
Another question. Let's see.
People over here.
Trying to, yes, over here with the, yes, brown hat.
Young man, I'm hard of hearing, don't get older. I think he sort of stole my thunder, but I had read the comment you made about the upper 5% several years ago. And the upper
into the mic. Would you speak in the mic? Yeah.
The Wall Street Journal. And I was thinking about years ago in Econ 101, if it was the upper 10%, you might be looking for a situation that's happening in Cairo. Now, I used to travel or go all over Mexico on old buses and trains and et cetera. And I was amazed. And I had seen all these murals in Mexico City after the Mexican Revolution. And
you want to get to the
yes,
question?
Yes, I have a question. Now, the thing is, now it is not safe for me to go down and travel and climb those old pyramids out of Mexico City. What are they doing? They're shooting each other. They're killing each other like crazy, especially in south of El Paso. Mm-hmm. And in the last 30 years in this country, what are they doing? sometimes it has not even been able to walk on the mean streets of Los Angeles.
To the question?
My question is, does crime really come about because of poverty? Many people say it doesn't. I think it does.
Right. Well, I would agree with that.
Right.
Yes. All right, let's go for another one. Right behind, yes, right, that's it, right there.
Quick question, since you did a study of history, other than like early United States, where now is capitalism working the best? The interesting thing about, you said about China, they kind of seem to have the best of both worlds in the sense that the government doesn't have the political argument, they just, you know, you put lead in the toys, they go kill somebody, the head guy, you know. Are there other places in the world that capitalism is working better than in the U.S.?
Well, I think most people point to Scandinavian countries where you see capitalism, a great deal more responsibility and a narrower gap, income gap. I think the Scandinavian countries give us an example of what can be done. And there are many, many differences between them and the United States. But nonetheless, there isn't a single thing that the Scandinavians do that we couldn't adopt if our collective will was behind those goals. I don't think it would be that hard to make. I don't think it would be that hard to make capitalism responsible. But as Peter has said, there's such a mountain to climb between the programs that would make it so and our getting to those programs, getting them passed. But it's not as though it's really puzzling, as though there are no solutions to making it more socially responsible. It's just so difficult politically to do it. And so, but at the same time, this is a democracy. It is representative government. There is a discussion going on right now about the parlous state of the world economy and debt and risk taking and the like. And I think it could easily become one of those moments. So I would make a distinction between the programs to solve these problems and getting those programs adopted.
Okay, on this side of the. Yes.
50 years ago.
Yeah.
Can you ask a question?
Yeah. 50 years ago, there were two economic systems, totally managed communism and laissez-faire communism.
Capital.
The third way has evolved, which is a managed economy in China, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia. In the last 20 or 30 years, hundreds of millions of people have come up from dire poverty. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? How did that work? And could that be exported?
Well, they're coming up to, they're not anywhere near where we are in terms of wealth per capita. They're coming up from an extraordinarily low base. If China does match the American economy, we will still have 10 times the individual wealth and income per person than China has. You know, people mention China, and it's an amazing story, but if you ever examine the control that the Communist Party exerts over people's lives down to the tiniest, most intimate detail, so China would never be my example of an economy that you would want to emulate. I think also both India and China have increased the span of inequality. They both very publicly say they don't approve this inequality, but they do, in fact, have an inequality of wealth that's far greater than that of the United States. I don't think that we should be too down on our system, even though in a good critical fashion we can see ways that it's got to be improved. And as Peter has pointed out, we are up against the time clock of what we're doing to the environment. Do you want to?
No, let's go, yes, back there.
I frequently hear it said that we need to have poor people get a bigger piece of the American pie, and I think that's what I hear you saying, Joyce. I say a bigger piece of the American pie that is killing us all. But my question to you both is, I didn't hear either of you distinguish in anything you said tonight between the quality of life and the standard of living. And there are, or right, distinguishing between poverty of spirit and poverty of stuff.
Yes. Well, that's a very good point, and I get into it in my book. I didn't talk about it here, but right. We have a fundamental misconception that simply increasing the gross domestic product, producing more crap, or as Dr. Zeus put it in The Lorax, thneeds. Did any of you familiar with The Lorax? I mean, stuff like this that we don't really need, but they're kind of fun. Anyway, doing all of that does not increase our quality of life after a certain point. I mean, there have been a lot of studies about this recently that show that, you know, poverty is not good for anybody's quality of life. So you've got to get people up to a certain basic level of prosperity and security before their quality of life, you know, is what we would want. But there is diminishing returns after you reach that point where you're just producing more and more and people are working harder and harder and getting deeper and deeper in debt just so that they can buy the latest need, and it really does not increase the quality of life. This is true. Now, how do you improve the quality of life, I guess, is the next part of that question, if it's not just by producing more crap? Well, it has to do, I think, the answer has to do with strengthening some of the institutions of the community and of what I call the commons, you know, the public libraries, the internet, the schools, the farmers markets, the things that people can participate in. Oh, and of course, universal health insurance is a key part of that as well. I mean, not this sort of crazy Obamacare, but, you know, something like they have in Canada or some of the European countries, where you assure everybody that they're going to be covered no matter what, and it doesn't consume 16 or 17% of GDP. It actually is efficient as well as fair. These are the kinds of things we need to do to improve the quality of life. And, you know, Joyce, you want to?
No, and I would agree with that, though I would still think I'd want people to be able to make their own choices about buying the crap or not.
Yeah. All right, let's go over to this side. Yes.
I think maybe two more questions.
Okay. Yeah, two more. Yeah.
Kind of piggybacking off the other questions. Socialism and socialist are the biggest scare words right now of our time, have been probably for quite a while. You talk about wages, kind of equalizing those, or with our national assets, you know, having everyone benefit from what we have naturally. I know that if these points are brought up, though, they'll be labeled as socialism, socialist, regardless of whether people are, you feel good, bad, indifferent about socialism or socialist. Are those points valid? I can't say I know enough about the systems to know the clear definitions between where one begins and where one ends. So if you could please just school me on where the difference is and when that point is brought up, as it will be, I'm sure.
Well, when that word is, you know, used by Bill O'Reilly or, you know, any of those people, you know, you just don't take it seriously. It's just spin. But in terms of what I think both Joyce and I, we have kind of, we're not anti-capitalist. I mean, we like, as Joyce was saying, the freedom and the ability of people to get out and take initiative and all that is a good thing. So we're and completely centralized command and control type economies, what socialist might mean, or at one point perhaps did mean, although there have been many definitions of socialism, we don't want to get into all that. That's not what we're advocating. We believe in markets, but there have to be, the way I would put it is that you have to have the right balance within markets. You know, we have these corporations that are very powerful, and they operate according to a calculus, which is just to maximize their short-term profit and everything else be damned. We need to offset that with other institutions that have a different calculus, which takes into account the long term, future generations, the integrity of the planet, the quality of life of people who are living today. If you can get that balance right, and then government has a role in doing that, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have a completely socialist economy. But if you can get the balance right, you can still have room for free enterprise and profit seeking. That's okay. But, you know, that's where I would be heading. Yeah.
I won't comment, so we'll have one more question. Yeah. Get one more question in.
Okay, the man in the middle. That's you. Right.
This is for Ms. Appleby. You commented that one way of bringing about change in attitude, less greed, less corruption, more social responsibility, is through the enactment of laws. I'm hoping you'll agree with me that another way of accomplishing that would be at the educational level. The MBA programs teaching courses on moral responsibility, social responsibility, and such. Having said that, and hoping you agree with me, although this happened a number of years ago, would you comment, especially having been affiliated with UCLA, could you comment on UCLA providing Michael Milken, the symbol of greed and corruption and immorality, the opportunity to teach a graduate class in finance at UCLA?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. I would like to, but it obviously was funny. Did you hear it?
Yeah, do you know who Michael Milken is?
Briefly, to comment...
I know who he is. He's not at UCLA.
Michael
is not at UCLA.
He taught a graduate school in finance at UCLA.
Right.
Given that opportunity, being the symbol of everything that institutions, educational and political, are supposed to try and change.
I bet he knew a lot about finance.
Yeah.
And UCLA is interested in experts, so as long as he wasn't doing it from prison, I don't think they would have any objection.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.